Visiting with us today is Joe Bast, who is the president of the Heartland Institute. What is the Heartland Institute? It's a well-known think tank, perhaps not as heavily funded as some of the others that you know about, but very vigorous in their many programs. Essentially, a scholarly outfit with interest in practical issues and practical solutions. And the overall point of view is libertarian. The Heartland Institute, Joe Bast, the president thereof. Are you now, or have you ever been, the recipient of a 501c4 status?
No, we have not. Nope, Heartland is a 501c3 organization. The distinction is we're a charitable organization that only does educational work. We very, very rarely get involved in lobbying, whereas a 501c4 is allowed to lobby.
But then you do have tax exemption.
We do. Privileges. Yeah, contributions are tax deductible.
Did that come in through easily? You understand why I'm asking all of this.
I do indeed. It came through 29 years ago.
A long time ago.
Ronald Reagan was in the White House at the time. And as I recall it, it didn't take more than 4 or 5 months for our application to come through. And knock on wood, we have not had any problems with the IRS in recent years.
Do they intrude with some special questions about your programs and the personal preferences of your staff members and so on?
They do not. Every year we file, like all nonprofit groups do, an annual tax form. I think we're very careful and always have been to file those forms on time, completely, accurately. And we have an independent audit every year that's very detailed. We've got a couple of CPAs on our board. We do monthly financial reports. So I think if we've ever been singled out for review by the IRS, they probably look at that and say these guys are probably not a good target.
You seem to me to be somewhat smaller in terms of staffing than, say, Heritage Foundation or AEI. But it seems to me you produce as much or much more material in terms of printed matter and matter up on the Internet than they do.
We produce a lot, but they produce a lot as well. Yeah, we're about $6 million a year. I think Heritage Foundation now is about $60 million, so they're 10 times our size. A couple of things that make us distinctive. Being in the Midwest, I think our cost structure is lower than some of the other organizations that are based in the Beltway. We do make a bigger focus on printing large quantities of our publications. A typical policy analysis or policy study that comes out of Cato or Heritage or AEI might only go to 500 people or 5,000 people. We make an effort to send these things to 20,000 or 50,000 people. We have big print runs that include all the national, state, and most local elected officials. And we'll often build in-house or rent large lists of influential people all across the country.
How do you relate to, how do you compare to Cato, to AEI, to Heritage, in terms of guiding policy, principle, ideology, et cetera?
Mm-hmm. Heritage Foundation is the country's leading conservative think tank, does a wonderful job of that. Cato is the country's leading libertarian think tank. They do a great job of that. Heartland tries to combine conservative and libertarian groups. We try to find common ground between these two or ideologies and try not to pick at the issues that separate us and instead focus on the issues that bring us together. Secondly, we focus on state legislatures rather than Congress. So there's about 7,300 state legislators in the United States. We're the only free market think tank that mails research and commentary to all 7,300 of these legislators over and over again. So it gives us a niche.
You describe yourself as a free market think tank rather than a libertarian think tank, or are they synonymous?
Both of those words are code in various people's worlds or in various contexts, so I use them interchangeably. I think free market is probably a less loaded phrase because it's a little more precise. We look for market-based solutions to social and economic problems.
And you argue, it's a basic principle of the organization, that market-based solutions will do wondrous improvement in medical care, in education, in environmental maintenance, et cetera, et cetera.
That's correct. Yeah, in each of those areas, I think we can identify problems that are created by too much reliance on government, and how relying more on the private sector, voluntary solutions, can solve these problems.
As you know, I've been a teacher all my life, university, and I'm very fascinated in the question of what's wrong with American preparatory education, public education, and for that matter, college and university education. How has too much reliance on government tended to influence and to injure the quality of our education?
It's a great example of where the problems, I think, are so clear and so major that people from both sides of the political aisle and all range of the ideological spectrum ought to get together and agree on this. We have a public education system, K-12, where half of the kids are flunking out, where half of the kids who graduate aren't prepared to go on to college, where we can't even keep kids safe in schools from drugs, from violence, from sexual abuse, you name it. We've created a situation where many teachers are burned out, where they have no option but to stay in the classroom for another 10 or 15 years to get their pensions and their benefits. It is unfair to everybody, teachers, administrators.
Are you describing the Chicago public school system or something more broadly?
I'm describing three-quarters of all public schools
in
the United
States. You really
see
it that way, do you?
I really see that it's a pervasive problem. It's not just Chicago. There are worse schools everywhere around the country. Yeah. And what's the origin or what's the root? What's the root cause of that situation? And I think it's fundamentally that the incentive structure that is in place in these schools is dysfunctional. You have schools that don't compete with one another for students or for teachers or for funds, where there are no consequences for a failure to educate, where the administrators and the school board superintendents have no incentive to negotiate hard with the teacher unions. And nobody's accountable for anything. They always have an excuse. It's the parents' fault. It's the kids' fault. We need more money. It's a different curriculum. And finally, they get to evaluate their own results. They get to set the standards and then judge whether or not they meet the standards. I mean, it's just a perverse, terrible situation that could be dramatically improved with competition and choice. And
that's competition what we propose. Between what organizations?
I would say among schools, between private schools and public schools especially. Allow parents to enroll their children in private schools, give them vouchers or scholarships to pay for tuition, let them choose the schools that their kids attend, and then let the school that loses those kids also lose the money that it otherwise would have got to educate those kids.
Now, we've had voucher plans adopted in some cities. Nearby, Milwaukee has done that, I believe.
That's correct, for 20 years.
And we've had charter schools. We've even got some in Chicago.
That's correct.
They've got them in Milwaukee. They've got them all over the country. Have they made any significant contribution to improving the quality of education and the performance levels attained by the students?
Yes. Short answer, yes. About 250,000 kids now are attending private schools using vouchers or tax credits. Mm-hmm. And some of these programs, like the one in Milwaukee now, go back 20 years. They've been very carefully studied. We have studies where kids are assigned into the program through random selection because more kids apply than are able to participate in the program. And that creates a situation where you can do a gold standard study of random distribution of kids into a control group and see how they compare. So a lot of research has been done. I think the overwhelming majority of those studies find that there's a positive impact on student achievement, graduation rate, and the rate at which kids go on to college. And, of course, parents love school choice. It creates much more accountability to them.
Well, who's opposing it? Who's resisting it?
Teacher unions primarily, but not just teacher union leaders. It's also superintendents. Texas, for example. Texas has supermajority Republican control of the House and the Senate. It has the lieutenant governor and the governor. The Republicans could do anything they wanted in the state of Texas. You would think that they would introduce some kind of voucher or tax credit program, but they won't. And the reason is the superintendents oppose it. Superintendents are very powerful politically. They don't want competition and choice any more than the teacher unions do. It's going to make them look bad. It's going to make it hard for them to plan next year's budget when they're not sure how many kids are going to choose to be in this school or that school.
I guess you could draw upon the old Roman insight. If you want to understand how things work, ask cui bono, who profits?
That's right, yeah. And right now, superintendents and even school board members are getting power, recognition. They're often used as a as a launching pad for a political career. Yeah. And there's almost no obligation, no accountability. You can be a school board member for 2 years or 4 years and move on. The school will be a ruinous wreck 20 years from now because you gave in to teacher demands for more tenure and more pay and more pension benefits. But you're not going to be around to take responsibility for
that.
So
what do you do here at Heartland about